Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to resume with the novel When William Came by Hector Human Roe, out of the Complete Stories of Saki. Again, sort of a novella of limited length, under 100 pages. Today we'll do this is the second session of this novel, we'll do chapters 4 to 6, as we did 1 to 3 the first time. So 4 to 6, chapter 4, Es ist verboten, it is forbidden. Yeovil wakened next morning to the pleasant sensation of being in a household where elaborate machinery for the smooth achievement of one's daily life was noiselessly and ceaselessly at work. Fever and the long weariness of convalescence in indifferently comfortable surroundings had given luxury a new value in his eyes. Money had not always been plentiful with him in his younger days. In his 28th year, he had inherited a fairly substantial fortune, and he had married a wealthy woman a few months later. It was characteristic of the man and his breed that the chief use to which he had put his newly acquired wealth had been in seizing the opportunity which it gave him for indulging in unlimited travel in wild, out-of-the-way regions where the comforts of life were meagerly represented. Sicily occasionally accompanied him to the threshold of his expeditions, such as Cairo or St. Petersburg or Constantinople, but her own tastes in the matter of roving were more or less condensed within an area that comprised Cannes, Hamburg, the Scottish Highlands, and the Norwegian fjords. Things outlandish and barbaric appealed to her, chiefly when presented under artistic but highly civilized stage management on the boards of Covent Garden. And if she wanted to look at wolves or sand grouse, she preferred doing it in the company of an intelligent fellow of the Zoological Society on some fine Sunday afternoon in Regent's Park. It was one of the bonds of union and good fellowship between her husband and herself that each understood and sympathized with the other's tastes without in the least wanting to share them. They went their own ways and were pleased and comrade-like when the ways happened to run together for a span, without self-reproach or heart-searching when the ways diverged. Moreover, they had separate and adequate banking accounts, which constitute, if not the keys of matrimonial heaven, at least the oil that lubricates them. So they had money, time, and space to do what they wanted, and that's a large part of the reason they got along. And we know that money is one of the top three reasons that people get divorced, so a lot of truth to it. Yeovil found Sicily and breakfast waiting for him in the cool breakfast room and enjoyed, with the appreciation of a recent invalid, the comfort and resources of a meal that had not to be ordered or thought about in advance, but seemed as though it were there, foreordained from the beginning of time in its smallest detail. Each desire of the breakfasting mind seemed to have its realization in some dish, lurking unobtrusively in hidden corners until asked for. Did one want grilled mushrooms, English fashion? They were there, black and moist and sizzling, and extremely edible. Did one desire mushrooms a la Russe? They appeared, blanched and cool and toothsome under their white blanketing of sauce. At one's bidding was a service of coffee, prepared with a rather more forethought and circumspection than would go into the preparation of a revolution in a South American republic. The exotic blooms that reigned in profusion over the other parts of the house were scrupulously banished from the breakfast room. Bowls of wild thyme and other flowering weeds of the meadow and hedgerow gave it an atmosphere of country freshness that was in keeping with the morning meal. "You look dreadfully tired still," said Sicily critically. "Otherwise, I would recommend a ride in the park before it gets too hot. There is a new cob in the stable that you will just love, but he is rather lively, and you had better content yourself for the present with some more sedate exercise than he is likely to give you. He is apt to try and jump out of his skin when the flies tease him. The park is rather jolly for a walk just now." "I think that will be about my form after my long journey," said Yeovil, "an hour's stroll before lunch under the trees. That ought not to fatigue me unduly. In the afternoon I'll look up one or two people." "Don't count on finding too many of your old set," said Sicily rather hurriedly. I dare say some of them will find their way back sometime, but at present there's been rather an exodus. The Breeds, said Yeovil, are they here? No, the Breeds are in Scotland, at their place in Sutherlandshire. They don't come south now, and the Ricards are farming somewhere in East Africa, the whole lot of them. Vallum has got an appointment of some sort in the Straits settlement, and has taken his family with him. The Collards are down at their mother's place in Norfolk. A German banker has bought their house in Manchester Square. And the Hebways? Asked Yeovil. Dick Hebway is in India, said Cicely, but his mother lives in Paris. Poor Hugo, you know, was killed in the war. My friends, the Allensons, are in Paris, too. It's rather a clearance, isn't it? However, there are some left, and I expect others will come back in time. Pitherby is here. He's one of those who are trying to make the best of things under the new regime. He would be, said Yeovil, shortly. It's a difficult question, said Cicely, whether one should stay at home and face the music, or go away and live a transplanted life under the British flag. Either attitude might be dictated by patriotism. It is one thing to face the music, it is another thing to dance to it, said Yeovil. Cicely poured out some more coffee for herself and changed the conversation. You'll be in to lunch, I suppose. The clubs are not very attractive just now, I believe, and the restaurants are mostly hot in the middle of the day. Ronnie Storey is coming in. He's here pretty often these days, a rather good-looking young animal with something midway between talent and genius in the piano-playing line. Not long-haired and Semitic or Czech or anything of that sort, I suppose, asked Yeovil, spelled Czech, T-C-E, T-C-H-E-Q-U-E. Cicely laughed at the vision of Ronnie conjured up by her husband's words. No, beautifully groomed and clipped and Anglo-Saxon. I expect you'll like him. He plays bridge almost as well as he plays the piano. I suppose you wonder at anyone who can play bridge as well as who can play bridge well wanting to play the piano. I'm not quite so intolerant as all that, said Yeovil. Anyhow, I promise to like Ronnie. Is anyone else coming to lunch? Joan Martle will probably drop in. In fact, I'm afraid she's a certainty. She invited herself in that way of hers that brooks of no refusal. On the other hand, as a mitigating circumstance, there will be a point d'asperge omelette, such as few kitchens could turn out, so don't be late. I guess that's an asparagus omelette. Yeovil set out for his morning walk with a curious sensation of one who starts on a voyage of discovery in a land that is well known to him. He turned into the park at Hyde Park Corner and made his way along the familiar paths and alleys that bordered the Row, capital R. The familiarity vanished when he left the region of fenced-in lawns and rhododendron bushes and came to the open space that stretched away beyond the bandstand. The bandstand was still there, and a military band in sky-blue Saxon uniform was executing the first item in the afternoon program of music. Around it, instead of the serried rows of green chairs that Yeovil remembered, was spread out an acre or so of small round tables, most of which had their quota of customers, engaged in the steady consumption of lager beer, coffee, lemonade, and syrups. Farther in the background, but well within earshot of the band, a gaily painted pagoda restaurant sheltered a number of more commodious tables under its awnings and gave a hint of convenient indoor accommodation for wet or windy weather. So it's being turned into the way the British did it, a bunch of green, like folding chairs, I guess, listening to the band, whereas the German way is a beer garden type thing. Movable screens of trellis-trained foliage and climbing roses formed little hedges by means of which any particular table could be shut off from its neighbors if semi-privacy were desired. One or two decorative advertisements of popularized brands of champagne and Rhine wines adorned the outside walls of the building, and under the central gable of its upper story was a flamboyant portrait of a stern-faced man whose image and superscription might also be found on the newer coinage of the land. A mass of bunting hung in folds round the flagpole on the gable and blew out, now and then, on a favoring breeze, a long three-colored strip, black, white, and scarlet. And over the whole scene, the elm trees towered with an absurd, sardonic air of nothing having changed around their roots. Yeovil stood for a minute or two, taking in every detail of the unfamiliar spectacle. "They have certainly accomplished something that we never attempted," he muttered to himself. Then he turned on his heel and made his way back to the shady walk that ran alongside the row. At first sight, little was changed in the aspect of the well-known exercising ground. One or two riding masters cantered up and down as of yore, with their attendant broods of anxious-faced young girls and awkwardly bumping women pupils, while horsey-looking men put marketable animals through their paces or drew up to the rails for long conversations with horsey-looking friends on foot. Sportingly attired young women, sitting astride of their horses, careered by at intervals as though an extremely game fox were leading hounds a merry chase a short way ahead of them. It all seemed much as usual. Presently, from the middle distance, a bright patch of color set in a whirl of dust drew rapidly nearer and resolved itself into a group of cavalry officers extending their chargers in a smart gallop. They were well mounted and sat their horses to perfection, and they made a brave show as they raced past Yeovil with a clink and clatter and rhythmic thud thud of hoofs, and became once more a patch of color in a whirl of dust. An answering glow of color seemed to have burned itself into the gray face of the young man who had seen them pass without appearing to look at them. A stinging rush of blood accompanied by a choking catch in the throat and a hot white blindness across the eyes. You can tell by the way he described that these were Germans, and he's irritated that this is his country and they're riding around like they own it. The weakness of fever broke down at times the rampart of outward indifference that a man of Yeovil's temperament builds coldly round his heartstrings. The row and its riders had become suddenly detestable to the wanderer. He would not run the risk of seeing that insolently joyous cavalcade come galloping past again. Beyond a narrow stretch of tree-shaded grass lay the placid sunlit water of the Serpentine, and Yeovil made a short cut across the turf to reach his graveled to reach its graveled bank. "Can't you read either English or German?" asked a policeman who confronted him as he stepped off the turf. Yeovil stared at the man and then turned to look at the small, neatly printed notice to which the official was imperiously pointing. In two languages, it was made known that it was forbidden and verboten, punishable and strafbar, to walk on the grass. "3 shilling fine," said the policeman, extending his hand for the money. "Do I pay you?" asked Yeovil, feeling almost inclined to laugh. "I'm rather a stranger to the new order of things." "You pay me," said the policeman, "and you receive a quittance for the sum paid." And he proceeded to tear a counterfoil receipt for a 3 shilling fine from a small pocketbook. "May I ask," said Yeovil, as he handed over the sum demanded and received his quittance, "what the red and white band in your sleeve stands for?" "Bilingual," said the constable, with an air of importance. "Preference is given to members of the force who qualify in both languages. Nearly all the police engaged on park duty are bilingual. About as many foreigners as English are in the parks nowadays, or use the parks nowadays. In fact, on a fine Sunday afternoon, you'll find 3 foreigners to every 2 English. The park habit is more continental than British, I take it." "Are there many Germans in the police force?" asked Yeovil. "Well, yes, a good few. There had to be," said the constable. "There were such a lot of resignations when the change came, and they had to be filled up somehow. Lots of men, what used to be in the force, emigrated or found work of some other kind, but everybody couldn't take that line. Wives and children had to be thought of. 'Tisn't every head of a family that can chuck up a job on the chance of finding another. Starvation's been the lot of a good many what went out. Those of us what stayed got better pay than we did before, but then, of course, the duties are much more multitudinous." So they see German culture as much more officious, more officials, more minor laws, less freedom, less individualized, less individualism. They see themselves as freer and more individualistic than Germans. That's their stereotype and their belief about Germans. "They must be," said Yeovil, fingering his 3 shilling state document. "By the way," he asked, "are all the grass plots in the park out of bounds for human feet?" "Everywhere you see the notices," said the policeman, "and that's about 3/4 of the whole grass space. There's been a lot of new gravel walks opened up in all directions. People don't want to walk on the grass when they've got clean paths to walk on." "Well, this person did, and he's just ignoring that." And with this parting reproof, the bilingual constable strode heavily away, his loss of consideration and self-esteem as a unit of a sometime ruling race, sometime meaning formerly, evidently compensated for to some extent by his enhanced importance as an official. The women and children, thought Yeovil as he looked after the retreating figure. Yes, that is one side of the problem. The children that have to be fed and schooled, the women folk that have to be cared for, an old mother, perhaps, in the home that cannot be broken up, the old case of giving hostages. He followed the path alongside the serpentine, passing under the archway of the bridge and continuing his walk into Kensington Gardens. In another moment, he was within view of the Peter Pan statue and at once observed that it had companions. On one side was a group representing a scene from one of the Grimm fairy stories. On the other was Alice in conversation with Griffon and Mock Turtle, the episode looking distressingly stiff and meaningless in its sculptured form. Two other spaces had been cleared in the neighboring turf, evidently for the reception of further statue groups, which Yeovil mentally assigned to Struvel Peter and Little Lord Fauntleroy. Struvel Peter is a Germanic kid always getting into mischief and serves as a sort of a moral example. So in the white world, or at least the Northern European world, you're going to learn Aesop and Alice in Wonderland and Mother Goose, and also Grimm's fairy tales. And Struvel Peter is a little more Germanic. It's not so much in English, but these are the main things that children are raised on, moral fables and tales, fairy tales. German middle-class taste, he commented, but in this matter we certainly gave them a lead. I suppose the idea is that childish fancy is dead, and that it is only decent to erect some sort of memorial to it. The day was growing hotter, and the park had ceased to seem a desirable place to loiter in. Yeovil turned his steps homeward, passing on his way the bandstand with its surrounding acreage of tables. It was now nearly 1 o'clock, and luncheon parties were beginning to assemble under the awnings of the restaurant. Lighter refreshments in the shape of sausages and potato salads were being carried out by scurrying waiters to the drinkers of lager beer at the small tables. A park orchestra in brilliant trappings had taken the place of the military band. As Yeovil passed, the musicians launched out into the tune which the doctor had truly predicted he would hear to repletion before he had been many days in London. The national anthem of the fait accompli. Sort of the furtive celebration of, oh well, they took over our country, but we best make the best of it, that we heard about in the first session, chapters 1 to 3. That ends chapter 4. Chapter 5, as I said, we're doing 5 and 6. L'art d'être cousine. The art of the cousin, I think. Maybe not. Maybe the cuisine. No, must be cousin. Joan Martel had reached 40 in the leisurely, untroubled fashion of a woman who intends to be comely and attractive at 50. She cultivated a jovial, almost joyous manner with a top dressing of hearty goodwill and good nature which disarmed strangers and recent acquaintances. On getting to know her better, they hastily rearmed themselves. Someone had once aptly described her as a hedgehog, the protective mimicry of a puffball. If there was an awkward remark to be made at an inconvenient moment before undesired listeners, Joan invariably made it, and when the occasion did not present itself, she was usually capable of creating it. She was not without a certain popularity, the sort of popularity that a dashing highwayman sometimes achieved among those who were not in the habit of traveling on his particular highway. A great aunt on her mother's side of the family had married so often that Joan imagined herself justified in claiming a cousinship with a large circle of disconnected houses and treating them all on a relationship footing, which theoretical kinship enabled her to extract luncheons and other accommodations under the plea of keeping the lamp of family life aglow. "I felt I simply had to come today," she chuckled at Yeovil. "I was just dying to see the return traveler. Of course, I know perfectly well that neither of you want me, when you haven't seen each other for so long, and must have heaps and heaps to say to one another. But I thought I would risk the odium of being the third person on an occasion when two are company and three are a nuisance. Wasn't it brave of me?" So see, that brave and stunning, that brave and stunning idea has been around a long, long time. She spoke in full knowledge of the fact that the luncheon party would not in any case have been restricted to Yeovil and his wife, having seen Ronnie arrive in the hall as she was being shown upstairs. So she's being disingenuous as well as an asshole. Ronnie's story is coming, I believe, said Cicely, so you're not breaking into a tete-a-tete, which means head-to-head, like Grand Teton's the same root word. Or no. I'm not sure if that means head or tit. I thought it meant head. Ronnie, oh, I don't count him, said Joan gaily. He's just a boy who looks nice and eats asparagus. I hear he's getting to play the piano really well. Such a pity. He will grow fat. Musicians always do, and it will ruin him. I speak feelingly because I'm gravitating towards plumpness myself. The divine architect turns us out fearfully and wonderfully built, and the result is charming to the eye. And then he adds another chin or two or three extra inches round the waist, and the effect is ruined. Fortunately, you can always find another Ronnie when this one grows fat and uninteresting. The supply of boys who look nice and eat asparagus is unlimited. Hello, Mr. Story. We were all talking about you. Nothing very damaging, I hope, said Ronnie, who had just entered the room. No, we were merely deciding that, whatever you may do with your life, your chin must remain single. When one's chin begins to lead a double life, one's own opportunities for depravity are insensibly narrowed. You needn't tell me that you haven't had any hankerings after depravity. People with your colored eyes and hair are always depraved. Let me introduce you to my husband, Ronnie, said Cicely, and then let's go and begin lunch. You two must almost feel as if you were honeymooning again, said Joan as they sat down. You must have quite forgotten each other's tastes and peculiarities since you last met. Old Emily Frondling was talking about you yesterday when I mentioned that Murray was expected home. Curious sort of marriage tie, she said in that stupid staring way of hers, when husband and wife spend most of their time in different countries, continents. I don't call it marriage at all. Nonsense, I said. It's the best way of doing things. The Yeovils will be a united and devoted couple long after heaps of their married contemporaries have trundled through the divorce court. I forgot at the moment that her youngest girl had divorced her husband last year and that her second girl is rumored to be contemplating a similar step. One can't remember everything. Joan Martle was remarkable for being able to remember the smallest details in the family lives of 200 or 300 acquaintances. From personal matters, she went with a bound to the political small talk of the moment. The official declaration as to the House of Lords is out at last, she said. I bought a paper just before coming here, but I left it in the tube. All existing titles are to lapse if 3 successive holders, including the present ones, failed to take the oath of allegiance. Have any taken it up to the present? Asked Yeovil. Only about 19 so far, and none of them representing very leading families. Of course, others will come in gradually as the change of dynasty becomes more and more an accepted fact, and of course there will be lots of new creations to fill up the gaps. I hear for certain that Pitherby is to get a title of some sort in recognition of his literary labors. He has written a short history of the House of Hohenzollern for use in schools, you know, and he's bringing out a popular Life of Frederick the Great. At least he hopes it will be popular. I didn't know that writing was much in his line, said Yeovil, beyond the occasional editing of a company prospectus. I understand his historical researches have given every satisfaction in exalted quarters, said Joan. Something may be lacking in the style, perhaps, but the august approval can make good that defect with the style of Baron. Pitherby has such a kind heart. Kind hearts are more than coronets, we all know. There's actually a movie called Kind Hearts and Coronets, a fairly famous comedy of the middle century. Kind hearts are more than coronets, we all know, but the two go quite well together. And the dear man is not content with his services to literature, he's blossoming forth as a liberal patron of the arts. He's taken quite a lot of tickets for Dear Gorla's debut, half the second row of the dress circle. Do you mean Gorla Mustelford? Asked Yeovil, catching at the name. What on earth is she having a debut about? What? Cried Joan in loud-voiced amazement. Haven't you heard? Hasn't Cicely told you? How funny that you shouldn't have heard. Why, it's going to be one of the events of the season. Everybody is talking about it. She's going to do suggestion dancing at the Caravansary Theater. Good heavens, what is suggestion dancing? Asked Yeovil. Oh, something quite new, explained Joan. At any rate, the name is quite new, and Gorla is new as far as the public are concerned, and that is enough to establish the novelty of the thing. Among other things, she does a dance suggesting the life of a fern. I saw one of the rehearsals, and to me it would have equally well suggested the life of John Wesley. He's the founder of Methodism. However, that is probably the fault of my imagination. I've either got too much or too little. Anyhow, it is an understood thing that she is to take London by storm. When I last saw Gorla Mustelford, observed Yeovil, she was rather a serious flapper who thought the world was in urgent need of regeneration and was not certain whether she would regenerate it or take up miniature painting. I forget which she attempted ultimately. She is quite serious about her art, put in Cicely. She studied a good deal abroad and worked hard at mastering the technique of her profession. She's not a mere amateur with a hankering after the footlights. I fancy she will do well. But what do her people say about it? Asked Yeovil. Oh, they're simply furious about it, answered Joan. The idea of a daughter of the House of Mustelford prancing and twisting about the stage for Prussian officers and Hamburg Jews to gaze at is a dreadful cup of humiliation for them. It's unfortunate, of course, that they should feel so acutely about it, but still one can understand their point of view. I don't see what other point of view they could possibly take, said Yeovil sharply. If Gorla thinks that the necessities of art or her own inclinations demand that she should dance in public, why can't she do it in Paris or even Vienna? Anywhere would be better, one would think, than in London under present conditions. He had given Joan the indication that she was looking for as to his attitude towards the fait accompli. Without asking a question, she had discovered that husband and wife were divided on the fundamental issue that underlay all others at the present moment. Cicely was weaving social schemes for the future. Yeovil had come home in a frame of mind that threatened the destruction of those schemes, or at any rate a serious hindrance to their execution. The situation presented itself to Joan's mind with an alluring piquancy. "You are giving a grand supper party for Gorla on the night of her debut, aren't you?" she asked Cicely. "Several people spoke to me about it, so I suppose it must be true." Tony Luton and young Story had taken care to spread the news of the projected supper function in order to ensure against a change of plans on Cicely's part. "Gorla is a friend of mine," said Cicely, trying to talk as if the conversation had taken a perfectly indifferent turn. "Also, I think she deserves a little encouragement after the hard work she has been through. I thought it would be doing her a kindness to arrange a supper party for her on her first night." There was a moment's silence. Yeovil said nothing, and Joan understood the value of being occasionally tongue-tied. "The whole question is," continued Cicely as the silence became oppressive, "whether one is to mope and hold aloof from the national life, or take our share in it. The life has got to go on, whether we participate in it or not. It seems to me to be more patriotic to come down into the dust of the marketplace than to withdraw oneself behind walls or beyond the seas." "Of course the industrial life of the country has to go on," said Yeovil. "No one could criticize Gorla if she interested herself in organizing cottage industries or anything of that sort, in which she would be helping her own people. That one could understand. But I don't think a cosmopolitan concern like music hall business calls for personal sacrifices from young women of good family at a moment like the present." "It is just at a moment like the present that the people want something to interest them and take them out of themselves," said Cicely argumentatively. "What has happened," and a lot of writing teachers would argue against using adverbs precisely like this. They would say you should only say said or says. You shouldn't critique it, or else you should word your stuff better so that people can see what's going on. You should be able to tell from the sentence, "It is just at a moment like the present that the people want something to interest them and take them out of themselves." You should tell that she's being argumentative without him having to use the adverb. That is the main school of thought, at least as I found it in formal education. What has happened, and we can't undo it or escape the consequences. What we can do, or attempt to do, is make things less dreary and make people less unhappy. In a word, more contented, said Yeovil. If I were a German statesman, that is the end I would labor for and encourage others to labor for, to make the people forget that they were discontented. All this work of regalvanizing the social side of London life may be summed up in the phrase, Travailler pour le roi de Prusse, working for the King of Prussia, I think is what that means. I don't think there is any use in discussing the matter further, said Cicely. I can see that grand supper party not coming off, said Joan provocatively. Ronnie looked anxiously at Cicely. You can see it coming on if you're gifted with prophetic vision of reliable kind, said Cicely. Of course, as Murray doesn't take kindly to the idea of Gorla's enterprise, I won't have the party here. I'll give it at a restaurant, that's all. I can see Murray's point of view and sympathize with it, but I'm not going to throw Gorla over, an expression they used back then. There was another pause of uncomfortably protracted duration. I say, this is a top-hole omelette, said Ronnie. That'd be the desperge. It was his only contribution to the conversation, but it was a valuable one. That's chapter 5. Chapter 6, Herr von Kvarl, K-W-A-R-L. Herr von Kvarl sat at his favorite table in the Brandenburg Café, the new building that made such an imposing show and did such thriving business, at the lower end of what most of its patrons called the Regentstrasse. Though the establishment was new, it had already achieved its unwritten code of customs, and the sanctity of Herr von Kvarl's specially reserved table had acquired the authority of a tradition. A set of chessmen, a copy of the Kreuzzeitung, and the Times, and a slim-necked bottle of Rhenish wine, ice-cool from the cellar, were always to be found there in the early in the forenoon, and the honored guest for whom these preparations were made usually arrived on the scene shortly after 11 o'clock. For an hour or so, he would read and silently digest the contents of his two newspapers, and then at the first sign of flagging interest on his part, another of the cafe's regular customers would march across the floor, exchange a word or two on the affairs of the day, and be bidden with a wave of the hand into the opposite seat. A waiter would instantly place the chessboard with its marshaled ranks of combatants in the required position, and the contest would begin. Herr von Kvarl was a heavily built man of mature middle age, of the blonde North German type, with a facial aspect that suggested stupidity and brutality. The stupidity of his mien masked an ability and shrewdness that was distinctly above the average, and the suggestion of brutality was belied by the fact that von Kvarl was as kind-hearted a man as one could meet with in a day's journey. Early in life, almost before he was in his teens, Fritz von Kvarl had made up his mind to accept the world as it was, and to that philosophical resolution, steadfastly adhered to, he attributed his excellent digestion and his unruffled happiness. Perhaps he confused cause and effect. The excellent digestion may have been responsible for at least some of the philosophical serenity. He was a bachelor of the type that is called confirmed, and which might better be labeled consecrated. From his early youth onward to his present age, he had never had the faintest flickering of intention of marriage. Children and animals he adored. Women and plants he accounted somewhat of a nuisance. A world without women in roses and asparagus would, he admitted, be robbed of much of its charm. But with all their charm, these things were tiresome and thorny and capricious and always wanting to climb or creep in places where they were not wanted and resolutely drooping or fading away when they were desired to flourish. Animals, on the other hand, accepted the world as it was and made the best of it. And children, at least nice children, uncontaminated by grown-up influences, lived in worlds of their own making. Von Kvarl held no acknowledged official position in the country of his residence, but it was an open secret that those responsible for the real direction of affairs sought his counsel on nearly every step they meditated, and that his counsel was very rarely disregarded. Some of the shrewdest and most successful enactments of the ruling power were believed to have originated in the brain cells of the bovine-fronted Stammgast of the Brandenburg Café. Around the wood-paneled walls of the café were set at intervals well-mounted heads of boar, elk, stag, roebuck, and other game beasts of northern forest, while in between were carved armorial escutcheons of the principal cities of the lately expanded realm, Magdeburg, Manchester, Hamburg, Bremen, Bristol, and so forth. Below these came shelves on which stood wonderful arrays of stone beer mugs, each decorated with some fantastic device or motto, and most of them pertaining individually and sacredly to some regular and unfailing customer. In one particular corner of the highest shelf, greatly at his ease and in no wise to be disturbed, slept Wotan, the huge gray house cat, dreaming doubtless of certain nimble and audacious mice down in the cellar 3 floors below, whose nimbleness and audacity were as precious to him as the forwardness of the birds is to a skilled gun or a grouse on a grouse moor. Once every day, Wotan came marching in stately fashion across the polished floor, halted midway to resume an unfinished toilet operation, and then proceeded to pay his leisurely respects to his friend Von Kvarl, K-W-A-R-L, which is not something I've ever seen of in German. The latter was said to be prouder of this daily demonstration of esteem than many of his coveted orders of merit. Several of his friends and acquaintances shared with him the distinction of having achieved the Black Eagle, but not one of them had ever succeeded in obtaining the slightest recognition of their existence from Wotan. The daily greeting had been exchanged, and the proud gray beast had marched away to the music of a slumberous purr. The Kreuzzeitung and the Times underwent a final scrutiny and were pushed aside, and Von Kvarl glanced aimlessly out at the July sunshine bathing the walls and windows of the Piccadilly Hotel. Herr Rabenach, the plump little Pomeranian banker, stepped across the floor almost as noiselessly as Wotan had done, though with considerably less grace, and some half-minute later was engaged in sliding pawns and knights and bishops to and fro on the chessboard in a series of lightning moves bewildering to look on. Neither he nor his opponent played with the skill that they severally brought to bear on banking and statecraft, nor did they conduct their game with the politeness they punctiliously observed in other affairs of life. A running fire of contemptuous remarks and aggressive satire accompanied each move, and the mere record of the conversation would have given an uninitiated onlooker the puzzling impression that an easy and crushing victory was assured to both the players. Ah, he is puzzled, poor man. He doesn't know what to do. Oh, he thinks he will move there, does he? Much good that will do him. Never have I seen such a mess as he is in. He cannot do anything. He is absolutely helpless, helpless. Ah, you take my bishop, do you? Much I care for that. Nothing. See, I give you a check. Ah, now he's in a fright. He doesn't know where to go. What a mess he is in. So the game proceeded, with a brisk exchange of pieces and incivilities and a fluctuation of fortunes, till the little banker lost his queen as the result of an incautious move, and after several woebegone contortions of his shoulders and hands, declined further contest. A sleek-headed piccolo rushed forward to remove the board, and the erstwhile combatants resumed the courteous dignity they had discarded in their chess-playing moments. "Have you seen the Germania today?" asked Herr Rabenach as soon as the boy had receded to a respectful distance. "No," said Von Kvarl, "I never see the Germania. I count on you to tell me if there is anything newsworthy in it." "It has an article today, headed Occupation or Assimilation," said the banker. "It is of some importance and well-written. It is very pessimistic." "Catholic papers are always pessimistic about the things of this world," said Von Kvarl, "just as they are unduly optimistic about the things of the next world." "What line does it take?" "It says that our conquest of Britain can only result in a temporary occupation with a notice to quit always hanging over our heads, that we can never hope to assimilate the people of these islands in our empire as a sort of maritime Saxony or Bavaria. All the teaching of history is against it. Saxony and Bavaria are part of the empire because of their past history. England is being bound into the empire in spite of her past history," and so forth. "The writer of the article has not studied history very deeply," said Von Kvarl. "The impossible thing that he speaks of has been done before, and done in these islands, too. The Norman conquest became an assimilation in comparatively few generations.
Ah, in those days, yes, said the banker, but the conditions were altogether different. There was not the rapid transmission of news and the means of keeping the public mind instructed in what was happening. In fact, one can scarcely say that the public mind was there to instruct. There was not the same strong bond of brotherhood between men of the same nation that exists now. Northumberland was almost as foreign to Devon or Kent as Normandy was, and the church in those days was a great instrumental international factor, and the Crusades bound men together, fighting under one leader for a common cause. Also, there was not a great national past to be forgotten, as there is in this case.
There are many factors, certainly, that are against us, conceded the statesman, but you must take into account those that will help us. In most cases in recent history where the conquered have stood against all attempts at assimilation, there has been a religious difference to add to the racial one. Take Poland, for instance, and the Catholic parts of Ireland. If the Bretons, that's the province in France, right, sort of the northwest part near England, if the Bretons ever seriously begin to assert their nationality as against the French, it will be because they have remained more Catholic in practice and sentiment than their neighbors. Here, there is no such complications. We are in the bulk a Protestant nation with a Catholic minority, and the same may be said of the British. Then, in modern days, there is the alchemy of sport and the drama to bring men of different races amicably together. One or two sportsmanlike Germans in a London football team will do more to break down racial antagonism than anything that governments or councils can effect. As for the stage, it has long been international in its tendencies. You can see that every day. The banker nodded his head. Remember, all these international football, or we call them soccer teams, have blacks on them in Europe.
London is not our greatest difficulty, continued von Kfarl. You must remember the steady influx of Germans since the war. Whole districts are changing the complexion of their inhabitants, and in some streets you might almost fancy yourself in a German town. We can scarcely hope to make much impression on the country districts and in the provincial towns at present, but you must remember that thousands and thousands of the more virile and restless-souled men have emigrated, and thousands more will follow their example. We shall fill up their places with our own surplus population as the Teuton races colonized England in the old pre-Christian days.
That is better, is it not, to people the fat meadows of the Thames Valley and the healthy downs and uplands of Sussex and Berkshire than to go hunting for elbow room among the flies and fevers of the tropics.
We have somewhere to go now, better than the scrub and the veldt and the thorn jungles.
Of course, assented Herr Rebenach. But while this desirable process of infiltration and assimilation goes on, how are you going to provide against the hostility of the conquered nation? A people with a great tradition behind them and the ruling instinct strongly developed won't sit with eyes closed and their hands folded while you carry on the process of Germanization. What will keep them quiet?
The hopelessness of the situation. For centuries, Britain has ruled the seas and been able to dictate to half the world in consequence. Then she let slip the mastery of the seas as something too costly and onerous to keep up, something which aroused too much jealousy and uneasiness in others, and now the seas rule her. Every wave that breaks on her shore rattles the keys of her prison. I'm no fire-eater, Herr Rebenach, but I confess that when I am at Dover, say, or Southampton, and see those dark blots on the sea and those gray specks in the sky, our battleships and cruisers and aircraft, and realize what they mean to us, my heart beats just a little quicker. If every German was flung out of England tomorrow, in 3 weeks' time we should be coming in again on our own terms. With our sea scouts and air scouts spread in organized network around, not a shipload of foodstuff could reach the country. They know that. They can calculate how many days of independence and starvation they could endure, and they will make no attempt to bring about such a certain fiasco. Brave men fight for a forlorn hope, but the bravest do not fight for an issue they know to be hopeless.
That is so, said Herr Rebenach. As things are at present, they can do nothing from within, absolutely nothing. We have weighed all that beforehand. But as the Germania points out, there is another Britain beyond the seas,
supposing the court at Delhi were to engineer a league.
A league? A league with whom?
Interrupted the statesman. Russia we can watch and hold. We are rather nearer to its western frontier than Delhi is, and we could throttle its Baltic trade at 5 hours' notice. France and Holland are not inclined to provoke our hostility. They would have everything to lose by such a course. There are other forces in the world that might be arrayed against us, argued the banker. The United States, Japan, Italy, they all have navies. Does the teaching of history show you that it is the strong power armed and ready that has to suffer from the hostility of the world? Answered von Quarl. As far as sentiment goes, perhaps, but not in practice. The danger has always been for the weak, dismembered nation. Think you a moment. Has the enfeebled, scattered British Empire overseas no undefended territories that are a temptation to her neighbors? Has Japan nothing to glean where we have harvested? Are there no North American possessions which might slip into other keeping? Has Russia herself no traditional temptations beyond the Oxus? Mind you, we are not making the mistake Napoleon made when he forced all Europe to be for him or against him. We threaten no world aggressions. We are satiated where he was insatiable. We have cast down one overshadowing power from the face of the world because it stood in our way, but we have made no attempt to spread our branches over all the space that it covered. We have not tried to set up a tributary Canadian Republic or to partition South Africa. We have dreamed no dream of making ourselves lord of Hindustan. On the contrary, we have given proof of our friendly intentions towards our neighbors. We backed France up the other day in her squabble with Spain over the Moroccan boundaries and proclaimed our opinion that the Republic had as indisputable a mission on the North African coast as we have in the North Sea. That is not the action or the language of aggression. No, continued von Quarl after a moment's silence, the world may fear us and dislike us, but, for the present at any rate, there will be no leagues against us. No, there is one rock on which our attempted assimilation will founder, or find firm anchorage. And that is? The youth of the country, the generation that is at the threshold now, it is them that we must capture. We must teach them to learn and coax them to forget. In course of time, Anglo-Saxon may blend with German, as the Elbe-Saxons and the Bavarians and Swabians have blended with the Prussians into a loyal united people under the scepter of the Hohenzollerns. Then we should be doubly strong. Rome and Carthage rolled into one. An empire of the West, greater than Charlemagne ever knew. Then we could look Slav and Latin and Asiatic in the face and keep our place as a central dominant force of the civilized world. The speaker paused for a moment and drank a deep draught of wine, as though he were invoking the prosperity of that future world power. Then he resumed in a more level tone. On the other hand, the younger generation of Britons may grow up in hereditary hatred, repulsing all our overtures, forgetting nothing, forgiving nothing, waiting and watching for a time when some weakness assails us, when some crisis entangles us, when we cannot be everywhere at once, then our work will be imperiled, perhaps undone. There lies the danger, there lies the hope. The younger generation. Remember, he's writing in reverse. This is about Germany and how Britain were wise to treat them after, you know, winning World War I. And before World War II, of course. There is another danger, said the banker, after he had pondered over von Quarl's remarks for a moment or two amid the incense clouds of a fat cigar, a danger that I foresee in the immediate future. Perhaps not so much a danger as an element of exasperation which may ultimately defeat your plans. The law as to military service will have to be promulgated shortly, and that cannot fail to be bitterly unpopular. The people of these islands will have to be brought into line with the rest of the empire in the matter of military training and military service, and how will they like that? Will not the enforcing of such a measure infuriate them against us? Remember, they have made great sacrifices to avoid the burden of military service. Dear God, exclaimed Herr von Quarl, as you say, they have made sacrifices on that altar. Remember, rearmament was a big thing, and we won't fight for a king or country was a big thing in Britain because they didn't want to be involved in another continental war, kind of the same way the U.S. was. But again, the machinations and intrigues of the Jews were ultimately to prevail in the 20th century in the Anglo world. And although it didn't lose, it did lose its empire, and it did lose power to the Jews the same way Germany did. Even if it just was in reality rather than in reality and appearance, as in Germany. Do you think he could have foreseen that 100 years later, Muslims would be gang raping millions of British children and nothing would be done about it? The cops would be afraid to go after them. Why would there be Muslims in Britain anyway? Do you think he foresaw any of that? If so, we haven't seen much note of it. That ends chapter 6. So we've done chapters 4, 5, and 6. This was session 2. Alex Linder reading to you out of Saki's When William Came, a story of Britain under the Hohenzollerns, in an alternate history, sort of a novella. Thanks for being with me. As always, you find what we record as part of our Learning College. All the audio can be found at vnnforum.com. Thanks for being with me. I'll be back with you again real soon.